But right now, we first want to get to Chip Gibbons. Chip Gibbons is the Policy and Legislative Counsel with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and he's also a writer whose work has been published in Jacobin, Truth Out and Counterpunch and more. Chip, appreciate you making time to join us on this program. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on your program.
Chip, maybe as before we get a start here, tell us a little bit about the groups you work with, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and also, I believe, has emerged with the group Defending Dissent Foundation.
Defending Dissent. Yeah. So sure. So about over a year ago, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and Defending Dissent Foundation merged together because we grew groups that had sort of similar visions of sort of like grassroots activism in order to promote civil liberties. And both groups on their own had very rich histories. The Bill of Rights Defense Committee was formed shortly after 9/11 by a librarian who was very concerned with the Patriot Act, and they went around in local communities and worked with the activists there and got their towns to pass resolutions against the Patriot Act. And then from there they moved on to trying to get local towns to pass ordinances limiting their cooperation with the federal government on certain intelligence and law enforcement matters, and barring racial profiling, which are even now more necessary with the Trump administration coming in. And then Defending Dissent Foundation was founded in 1960 as the National Coalition to Abolish the House Un-American Activities Committee. So they have a very, very rich history of standing up and fighting for dissent in terribly dark times, as well as, you know, less dark ones. And their founder, Frank Wilkinson, had actually been a victim of HUAC and had gone to jail after claiming the First Amendment protected his right not to testify before HUAC. And the case went to the Supreme Court, and they ruled against him. And the night before he went to jail, Martin Luther King held a banquet in his honor, and he actually had a 132,000-page FBI file. So we're very familiar with the ways in which the various repressive apparatuses of the state can be used to suppress dissent.
Thanks for that rundown, Chip. And the web address you can give out right now, we'll repeat it before we say goodnight.
www.bordc.org, BRDC, that's Bill of Rights Defense Committee, the abbreviation for it.
Okay. And, you know, as we begin here, I wondered if you would sort of give us an overview of what we know about Donald Trump's policies or views on civil liberties issues. And I think what we all know is that Donald Trump was quite vigorous in his denunciation of the media and those generally who were critical of him in his campaign and campaign rhetoric. He also called for violence of those who dared to disrupt or protest at his campaign rallies. Beyond that, I'm not sure I know a lot about his stance on civil liberties issues for the future, although I know he has endorsed torture. But I'm going to stop there and let you give us a fuller picture of what Donald Trump will bring to the White House on January 20th when he takes the oath of office when it comes to civil liberties.
I mean, it's really hard to pin down Donald Trump on any sort of specific policies. He's very good at being sort of slippery and going back and forth on things. But from what he said, we know that he is going to be a nightmare for civil liberties. He's talked about surveillance of Muslims. He mentioned spying on people in mosque. He's mentioned a national Muslim registry, and it's not sure if that would be something similar to what Barack Obama just disbanded, the NSEERS registry, which was of resident immigrants in the country based on their country of origin, where all of the different countries just happen to all be majority Muslim nations, or an actual literal Muslim registry. It's difficult to figure out what he means by it, but either way, it's very frightening and something to be opposed. He also tweeted about criminalizing flag burning. He said it should be, you know, either a year in jail or loss of citizenship, which is kind of a really weird incongruent two sets of punishments, but Donald Trump, and he's generally defended torture, as you've mentioned. He said some stuff about, you know, no one can tell me waterboarding doesn't work, which is interesting because one of his cabinet picks for Secretary of Defense told him waterboarding doesn't work, and he was allegedly surprised to hear that, which makes you realize that Trump doesn't usually listen to views other than his own. He said he'll do a whole lot worse than waterboarding. He said that, you know, even if he said, you know, there's a debate about whether or not waterboarding is torture. Let's assume it is torture. I'm all for it. I want to do worse than it. At one point he said, you know, even if it doesn't work, the people being waterboarded deserve it. So that's a really disturbing position on torture. The surveillance. He also praised stop and frisk during the debate, and he called for some sort of like national stop and frisk program, which doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because it's local police, not the FBI, who are responsible for like, you know, cursory stops on the street. But it does show that he is supportive of various policies that are tantamount to racial profiling, between his praising of stop and frisk to his really sort of unsettling comments about African-American communities, to his wanting of a Muslim registry and spying on mosques. It's clear that he's into racial and religious profiling, and the fact that he does not tolerate criticism and dissent very well, and will be having, you know, power over the NSA, over the FBI, and all these large surveillance apparatuses, is just sort of, you know, a nightmarish situation, which is what we were worrying everyone about, you know, for the last 16 years or so, you know, that if you keep building up these systems of repression, they can be abused. And of course, they have been abused by past administrations. So, you know, it wasn't like everything was rosy for civil liberties in the United States before Trump was elected. But, I mean, there has been a lot of people expressing concern about, you know, what Trump could do with the NSA. And it's just sort of like, well, you know, you shouldn't have built up a system like this that has the potential to be so terribly abused. And we also know that his cabinet picks are really unsettling, and it would seem to be that they would confirm a lot of what he said he was going to do on the campaign trail. He's picked people who are very pro-torture, who are very hostile to dissent, who have histories of racial or religious animus.
Well, that's a good rundown, Chip. Thank you so much. That was a great overview. It's kind of frightening, I would say.
Yeah. I'm sorry there's no good news.
Yeah.
But there is good news. I mean, there's good news in that there are activists all over the country right now who are very galvanized about Trump. And while there isn't a hopeful situation on the federal level, a lot of these policies and a lot of these programs do require the cooperation of local cities. And we have a number of ordinances on our website, model ordinances, that if, you know, you were to get some version passed in your hometown or city, would limit their ability to share some types of information with the federal government. It would limit their ability to spy on people for their religion or their political activity. It would limit racial profiling, would bar them from federal immigration authority. So it would really throw a cog in the wheel, or whatever. You throw a wrench in the wheel of sort of the Trump agenda to sort of destroy the Bill of Rights, because it is going to depend heavily on local communities, you know, playing some role. If they refuse to do so, it will, you know, not solve the problem completely, but it will frustrate him. And I think the outpouring of activism we see on the local level is very hopeful. So on the one hand, the proposed agenda of Trump is something to be concerned with, but the sort of grassroots mobilizing against it is cause for hope, and I think even celebration.
Yeah, no, before we say goodnight this evening, we'll talk a bit about the group's organizing and how people could get plugged into that. But I wanted to go to your article you wrote recently, earlier this in December, titled Meet Trump's Worst Nominees for Civil Liberties. And I'd like you to maybe talk about some, if not all, of the nominees that have raised alarm bells among the civil liberties community, folks who've got a record of action and rhetoric that run counter to our nation's traditions of upholding civil liberties in the Bill of Rights.
I mean, the worst and the one who's gotten the most attention rightfully from civil liberties and civil rights groups has been Jeff Sessions. And Jeff Sessions is currently a member of the United States Senate, but in the 1980s, he was nominated for the federal judiciary by Ronald Reagan. The Republicans controlled the Senate. His nomination was rejected when two Republicans on the Judiciary Committee broke with their colleagues to vote against him. And throughout the hearing, a bunch of really horrendous statements that he had made had come up. For example, he said that he used to think the Ku Klux Klan was okay until he found out they smoked pot. And when they asked him if he had said that, he said, yes, he had, but it was a joke. I don't think the African-American attorney he said that to found it very funny. He also was accused of having said that the ACLU and NAACP were un-American and communist groups for having forced civil rights down the throats of the people. And when he was asked about that, he didn't deny it. He said, "I'm often loose with my tongue. I may have said something about the NAACP being un-American or communist, but I meant no harm by it," which is a remarkable quote. He then went on to say that groups that are opposed to American foreign policy are un-American, so there's not a real high tolerance for dissent there. As at this time, he was an assistant attorney general or assistant U.S. attorney in the South, and he was involved in an FBI prosecution or a federal prosecution of three voting rights activists for voting fraud. All three were acquitted. It was largely viewed at the time as being racially motivated and attempting to sort of curb the power of black voters who had gained some rights under the Voting Rights Act. He brought an enormous number of charges against them, all of which the jury threw out. And it was, like I said, at the time, it was very much viewed as an attack on black voting rights. And as Attorney General, he is responsible for protecting those rights. There's also something else very shocking about him. I found, you know, he is obviously very anti-LGBTQ rights, and he's also very anti-dissent. And in addition to being a U.S. attorney and being a U.S. senator, he was the Attorney General of Alabama. And at that time, he wrote an opinion denying state funding to LGBTQ groups on college campuses. It was overturned by a federal court, which found that both Sessions' application of the law to those groups had violated the First Amendment, and both the law in general, which had been passed with the intent of barring these groups' fundings, had been unconstitutional. And he said some really horrendous things when he was denying these groups funding. He said something, really sort of vile about, you know, he's not an organization that professes to be comprised of homosexuals and or lesbians may not receive state funding or use state-sponsored facilities to foster or promote those illegal sexually deviant activities. So, I mean, you know, he clearly is also against marriage equality. He supports an amendment against that. He is against repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So he's against LGBT people having any rights, including First Amendment rights. And he also has been a supporter of torture. He was one of only 9 members of the Senate to vote against the McCain-sponsored anti-torture bill. He has been consistently in favor of very strong anti-immigration policies and mass deportations. I mean, it's just, he is sort of a horror show of a potential attorney general.
Well, that's Jeff Sessions.
That is Jeff Sessions. and the other thing, he's still very fixated on the ACLU. When he attacks various judicial nominees, he's described them on a number of occasions as one of having the ACLU gene. Another time, one had ACLU DNA, and on a third occasion, one had the ACLU chromosome. So he's very much against nominating people who like civil liberties to the federal judiciary, which, you know, is exactly where they should be. I think we should have judges that respect the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, but, you know, Jeff Sessions has a different sort of opinion on that one.
Now, you also profiled Michael Flynn, Trump's national security advisor, discuss a little bit about Lieutenant General Michael Flynn and what he brings to the job.
Flynn is an interesting character. He's extraordinarily Islamophobic and anti-Islam, and that's what he's gotten a lot of negative attention for. He's made a number of comments about the United States, you know, is being influenced by Sharia law. We're in a world war with radical Islam, stuff like that. He was pushed out of the Obama administration, which he was very bitter about. But the others on the flip side, and this is interesting to me, I don't know quite what to make about it. Before he got involved with Trump, he gave a talk in public where he was very critical of torture He was very much supportive of the Senate torture report. He criticized drone strikes and night raids in Afghanistan. But since he's gotten into Trump's orbit, a number of people in the media have asked him about his earlier sort of, you know, anti-torture commitment, and he has sort of flip-flopped on it. And there's another disturbing thing that I just learned about him recently is that when the coup in Turkey happened, he had initially supported the coup led by the military against the president, but then several months later flip-flopped and not only supported the crackdown of dissidents in Turkey, but supports the U.S. Extraditing a Turkish dissident who lives in Pennsylvania to Turkey, and Turkey has repeatedly asked the U.S. to extradite him, but because the charges are so clearly politically motivated, we have consistently refused to do so. So I don't necessarily know how much influence you would have over that process, but it's a little bit disturbing to think that a U.S. resident could be deported to extradited at the request of a fairly authoritarian country over politically motivated charges. Like, that is, you know, not something that we should want to happen in our country. And then one of the other generals in Trump's cabinet is General Kelly, and John Kelly. And he's flown under the radar a little bit. And I actually saw somewhere that he was one of the cabinet nominees that the Democrats are probably going to give a free pass. There was an article I saw earlier today about, you know, there were certain ones they were going to go after and certain ones they were going to give a free pass on. And I recall correctly, Kelly was one of them. But Kelly is actually extraordinarily concerning. I mean, he was head of Southcom, which, you know, covers U.S. operations in the Southern Hemisphere, and that includes the base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He made a comment about the only people who were mistreated at Guantanamo Bay were the prison guards, that all of the guys there are bad boys and deserve to be there. There was a Reuters expose that, according to it, he actively undermined Obama in trying to close down Guantanamo. So he's very much pro-Guantanamo. And the other thing about him that is concerning is his support for the war on drugs, which Jeff Sessions is also a major drug warrior, which is, you know, it's unsettling because at a time when I think most people are realizing that the war on drugs has been a colossal failure, we have two very diehard believers in it. But in the John Kelly case, you know, the military commander, he was in charge of it from a very militaristic aspect. And he's praised Plan Colombia, which was originally designed to counter narcotics trafficking in Colombia by FARC, the armed group. After 9/11, it became about narco-terrorism, you know, combining the war on drugs and the war on terror are two favorite excuses to undermine the Bill of Rights rolled into one, narco-terrorism. And the program has been, you know, very much opposed by human rights groups. The Colombian military engaged in a number of human rights abuses. It was the trade union murder capital of the world for a while, and, you know, Plan Colombia is largely considered for having exacerbated this, you know, the U.S. pouring military aid into a country that has, you know, paramilitary death squads that are acting with basically impunity, you know, certainly doesn't help the situation. But, you know, Kelly has written an article praising Plan Colombia. He said, you know, the values that we learn from Plan Colombia are, you know, really like respect for democracy and tolerance. And it's just tolerance, inclusion, and democratic values. That is what Plan Colombia teaches us. And it's like, well, if that was true, then maybe I would agree with you. But as head of Southcom, I think you know very well that's not true. And he's touted this plan as a model to take on ISIS. He's also said that he feels like both immigration and drugs are a national security threat to the U.S. There was an Intercept article about a very exaggerated figure he gave for the number of people who die from drug-related terrorism. He said something like 400,000 people a year die from drug-related terrorism, which is, I mean, it's a fantastical number. It's purely made up. So this is somebody who is a hardcore believer in the war on drugs and, you know, thinks that there's a military solution to it. And it's very disturbing because across the country we're seeing, at the local level, we're seeing a lot of police departments are increasingly becoming militarized. We've seen that in the response to protests at Standing Rock. We've seen that at the response, response to Black Lives Matter protest in Ferguson. So, you know, the idea of having someone in DHS who has helped facilitate some of this militarization of local police departments, you know, be a big advocate of you know, militarism and militarization is really alarming. And one of the things he said that he's going to do is he's going to end political correctness in national security, which is just like, I don't know what this political correctness is. I mean, we have torture, we have mass surveillance, we have extrajudicial killings of even American citizens in the form of drone strikes. So it's a little bit hard to figure out what this political correctness that is endangering us all. I mean, if this is the politically correct, you know, too soft approach, I think we're really in trouble for whatever Kelly wants.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Chip Gibbons, Policy and Legislative Counsel with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And Chip, I want to just make sure we have enough time to talk about effective opposition to these things. But do spend just a short bit here on Stephen Bannon, the chief strategist in the White House for Trump.
I mean, Stephen Bannon, his big problem is that he was editor of a news publication called Breitbart at a time when it became the self-described mouthpiece of alt-right. And according to a lot of observers and commentators, alt-right is just a pleasant term for white supremacy. And the type of stuff that they published included a very disturbing defense of the Confederate flag. He's very much a promoter of Islamophobia, and he's very much, you know, opposed to Black Lives Matter. So, I mean, it's difficult to pin a specific policy to him that he could be responsible for that is troubling. But his whole background of having supported this extreme far right, quite frankly, racist movement, raises serious questions about should he be in the president's inner circle. I also want to comment that Trump's pick for EPA head Scott Pruitt himself is no friend to civil liberties. As a state attorney general, he brought some sort of consumer advisory alert against the Humane Society, and the Humane Society sued him for politically motivated retaliation. He was very much an enemy of animal welfare groups. So there was some question as to whether or not he had acted inappropriately and brought a sort of, you know, baseless advisory against a group for political purposes. And, you know, I mean, we don't really think of the EPA as being a group that has, you know, an impact on civil liberties, but I think that any confirmation hearing for him should delve into this issue, because somebody who abuses their power of office to engage in political retaliation is not someone who is fit to serve in any office.
Well, Chip, as we wind up here, I wanted to ask you about this. With the Trump administration coming in with an agenda that includes registering Muslims who live in the United States, a ban on Muslims entering the United States, the pledged for mass deportation of immigrants, building a wall on the southern U.S. border with Mexico, the endorsement of mass surveillance or escalating mass surveillance, reviving the official government's sanctioning of torture, challenges to press freedom. What, in your view, is some of the most effective responses for opponents of these policy agenda items? What can people be doing to take action to place obstacles between the Trump administration and these objectives?
So I think that one of the most effective means of resistance is actually organizing at the local level to pass local ordinances that limit what your local law enforcement can do. So we have two ordinances on our website and a resolution. A resolution that is a non-binding statement. It's just sort of like, you know, we disagree with, you know, the climate of hatred, whereas an ordinance has the force of law. So it'll be like, our police are not allowed to cooperate with federal immigration policy or participate in mass deportations or spy on people because of their religion. And I think that it's clear that the current federal landscape is quite hostile to civil liberties. It doesn't mean we should give up or you know, just let them do it. But for a lot of people, particularly those who live in cities that are more open about civil liberties or more supportive and not supportive of the Trump agenda, there's a real window of opportunity for passing either of these model ordinances or some version of them and it would actually have the power of law, and it would limit what your local police could in fact do. I mean, a lot of people don't realize this, but, you know, through the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, a lot of times local police are involved in FBI investigations. And in some examples, you know, the FBI policies they're supposed to respect civil liberties are a lot lower than what the local police are supposed to do. So you get the question of, you know, are local police participating in, you know, violations of what we have, of the standards that we've held them to? So there's a number of ways of just limiting and restricting when local law enforcement can act with federal law enforcement, like banning them from sharing information that's not about pertaining to a crime. Like, obviously, you know, people want them to cooperate with the federal police to investigate actual crimes, but, you know, if they're sharing non-criminal information about citizens of the town with federal government, that's opening the door for some of these programs where the FBI goes in and harasses Muslims, which they already do. Like I said, it's not a glorious time for civil liberties in the United States right now. But so if you live in a city where you think your city council, you think the general population is more amenable to resisting the Trump agenda, you can really accomplish quite a lot by passing these ordinances. And if people are interested in doing so, they're both on our website at www.brdc.org. And I know, like, passing local resolutions or ordinances can seem like a daunting task, but other cities have done it. Like, I mean, there's a number of ways to contact us on our website about getting involved with this campaign, and we can help you get started and give you some pointers.
All right, Chip. Well, this has been very educational. We've learned a lot tonight about this rundown on civil liberties issues in the coming Trump administration, and the website, again, for a lot of these information.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just, go ahead, repeat the website.
www.brdc.org.
B-O-R-D-C dot O-R-G, and that stands for Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Got it. All right. Well, this is great. I'd love to stay in touch, Chip, so we can run this down more as these guys take power on January
20th. Anytime.
I laugh, but it's just for crying then. it's a tough road to
hoe.
Well, you've laid out a lot more we can do, so that's hopeful.
That's hopeful.
Or cry. All right. Thank you, Chip. Appreciate you being here on our first program of the new year. Take care.
Thank you for having me.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Chip Gibbons, Policy and Legislative Counsel with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And also, writer's work has been published in Jacobin, Truth Out and Counterpunch.